he'd thought so at first, but then he gave Costello a rundown of all the recent deaths and how all of them were linked back to Derone and his team in one way or another. Costello still couldn't believe it. He, like John and Aaron, knew each member of the Prime Minister's team on a first-name basis. They'd worked together for years. It seemed impossible that any of them could be involved in anything like this. But Costello agreed that the whole chain of events was suspicious, and he promised to proceed with caution and get back to him in a few hours. "How's Tracy doing?" Bennett asked before saying goodbye.
"You won't believe it," said Costello.
"What's that?"
"She just called me an hour ago with the news."
"What?"
"We're expecting."
Aaron speed-dialed Indira Rajiv at Langley. Fortunately, Washington was 7 hours behind them, and it was now only 6:30 in the evening there. Rajiv picked up on the second ring.
"Tell me you're not in the middle of this thing,"
Rajiv said immediately. "It's made the news there already?" Aaron asked, surprised even by the standards of American cable news.
"No, not yet,"
said Rajiv.
"I got a priority flash traffic from our consulate and dialed up Israeli TV off our satellite. The whole section is watching it. It's the first violence in the Muslim quarter since the firestorm. And you're in it, aren't you?"
"I'm afraid so," Aaron conceded, glad to have found a sympathetic voice.
"What happened?"
asked Rajiv.
"You guys okay?"
"We're fine," said Aaron. "I'll explain later. Right now, I need some help."
"Of course,"
said Rajiv.
"What do you need?"
"Two things," Aaron explained. "First, I need you to track down everything the agency has on a guy named Abdullah Farouk and get it to me overnight." There was a long pause on the other end of the line.
"Who is Abdullah Farouk?"
Rajiv finally asked. "I'm not sure," Aaron conceded. "It might be a rabbit trail, but I need to follow it for a bit and see where it leads."
"Okay,"
Rajiv said, an edge of reluctance in her voice.
"Let me see what I can do. Was there something else?"
Now Aaron paused. She had just asked one of her closest friends to break about 6 different federal laws by giving her classified information on Farouk when she was no longer working for the CIA. Was she really about to ask for more? She had no choice. Someone was hunting for them, and she needed to regain the initiative. She swallowed hard and said to Rajiv, "Yeah, actually, there is." Exasperated, Bennett ran his hands through his hair. "I don't believe you," he said at last. "I really don't believe you." "I know it looks bad, John, but looks bad. Aaron, are you crazy? Have you completely lost your mind? You're going to send us all to prison for the rest of our lives." "That wasn't my first concern," she said. "What was?" "Surviving." Bennett was beside himself. He wanted to scream at her, but he couldn't afford to wake up Natasha or the rest of the house, much less the neighborhood. "So, let me get this straight," he said, his mind still reeling. "You actually asked Indira Rajiv to log on to a secure CIA satellite account, zoom into Jerusalem, map out a secure route from the apartment where we're staying to Dr. Mordecai's house and back, and then feed that imagery to a password-protected web account that we can access on our BlackBerries?" "Pretty much," said Aaron. "So, despite the fact that we have a warm bed to sleep in, and a family willing to protect us, and access to friends in the White House and CIA who can help us out of this thing, you're actually proposing that we leave this house, sneak back through the Muslim quarter, and find our way to Dr. Mordecai's house?" "Right." "Because you have a death wish?" "No," Aaron shot back, "because someone has one for us." "And what exactly are we supposed to find at Dr. Mordecai's place?" "I don't know," said Aaron. "Not exactly." "Oh, great, that's helpful. Look, John, I'm exhausted. We both are. But we don't have a lot of choices right now, do we? We've got a lot of pieces to this puzzle, but I can't seem to make them fit, can you?" Bennett said nothing, so Aaron continued. "When the sun comes up, we're going to be pinned down here for another night, unless you want to go traipsing through the Muslim quarter in broad daylight." "Not with what tomorrow's headlines are going to bring," he said.
"Precisely my point," said Aaron. "If we're going to make a move, we have to make it now. I'm just hoping that if we can hack into Mordecai's files, we might come across something helpful, something we can use to figure this all out before it's too late."
Chapter 31. Thursday, January 15th, 2:44 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. An hour later, they were standing outside Mordecai's house. Officially, the house was under investigation and would be until the circumstances of Mordecai's death had been thoroughly studied, but most of the detective work here had already been done. The question now was whether there remained any clues to Mordecai's death that may not have been obvious to the Mossad or Shin Bet. Bennett followed his bride up the cobblestone path and realized this might very well be the last time they visited this remarkable home. He wondered how much this house carved into the hills would sell for. 6, 8 million, 10? He recalled how intrigued he'd been the first time he'd visited. He'd been struck at the time by an almost overpowering sense that the house was a reflection of the man inside, eclectic and unconventional, shrouded in mystery, infused with a hint of magic. Tonight was no different. For old time's sake, he wished they could ring the doorbell and once again hear the chimes echoing through the valley, as beautiful as those in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre not far away. Instead, he punched in the 9-digit security code Mordecai had taught them. To their surprise, it was still active, and they entered the front door. But this time, they were not greeted by armed Mossad agents. They were greeted instead by eerie silence. As they climbed the circular staircase into the great room, its walls covered with Jackson Pollock paintings, its shelves adorned with archaeological relics from all over the Near East, Bennett thought he could still pick up the faint smell of curry and coriander and turmeric with which Mordecai so often cooked, and the memories began to well up within him. It was on these very couches that he'd first heard the Ezekiel 38 and 39 prophecies. It was out there, on the stone porch, overlooking the old city, that Aaron had first shared her faith in Christ with him. Below his feet were the thick Persian rugs, once covered with the blood of Iraqi terrorists who had come in the middle of the night to hunt them down. And when he closed his eyes, he could still see the chalk outlines around the bodies, all these years later. Aaron made a right toward the kitchen and Mordecai's bedroom and private study. Bennett, on the other hand, turned left to look through the guest rooms where they had so often stayed. The beds were all made with fresh linens no one would ever use. Clean bath towels and washcloths were stacked neatly in wicker baskets at the foot of each bed, and, as always, each room had a collection of small soaps and bottles of shampoo, along with new toothbrushes and unused tubes of toothpaste, always prepared for another guest, though no more would ever come. He stopped over the section of hallway where his friend and colleague Dietrich Black had been killed, and where he had almost been as well. So much had happened since that night, yet the memories were still vivid, still painful, and he wondered when, if ever, they would begin to fade. He wondered, too, how Deke's family was holding up. He'd set up a scholarship fund for the girls and helped Katrina land a job outside of Philly as the executive secretary to a bank VP he'd known from Harvard. But it had been way too long since they had all seen each other. Aaron and Katrina still emailed each other occasionally, but less often than they had, and less often than Bennett wished. They had sent Katrina an invitation to their wedding, but had never received a reply. He made a mental note to give her a call when he got back to the States. Since the day he had been hired by the President of the United States to help bring about an Arab-Israeli peace treaty, he had known personally 53 people who were now dead. Funny how the mind kept track of the details. Most deaths he had witnessed firsthand, but of all of them, Mordecai's was by far the most painful. Already, Bennett missed him more than he had thought possible, even more than his own father, and though he knew with great certainty that he would see his old friend once again one day, it wasn't the same, and there was no use pretending that it was. There would be no more talks late into the night about politics and prophecy, no more marathon Scrabble tournaments that Bennett would always lose and Aaron would sometimes win. All that was over, and over too quickly. The only way to redeem it was to figure out why. His BlackBerry began to vibrate. He glanced at the screen. It was his mother. He gritted his teeth. She had the most incredible timing. "Hey, Mom, now is not the best time," he said, cupping his hand over his mouth to keep as quiet as possible.
"Why are you whispering? Is everything all right?"
asked Ruth Bennett from her townhouse in Orlando. I'm actually in the middle of something right now. Can I call you back?
Will you?
Of course I will.
You promise?
Of course I promise, he sighed. Every Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Have I missed one yet?
You're a good boy. I'm so, so sorry about Dr. Mordecai. Are you going to the funeral?
There's not going to be a funeral, Mom.
What are you talking about? There has to be a funeral. He was a great man.
They don't think of him that way here. But look, I really need to go. I'll call you tonight.
You know, I think I've settled on a church,
his mother continued, oblivious to the urgency in his voice.
It's a big one, about 15 minutes from me. The pastor is wonderful. You and Aaron really need to come down and hear him. He's doing a series on the end times right now. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. He actually quoted Dr. Mordecai last week. I just about fell out of my chair. I wanted to stand up and shout, I knew that guy, I knew him.
Bennett had to bite his tongue. He loved his mother dearly. The last thing he wanted was to communicate any disrespect, but sometimes...
Anyway, the pastor said Dr. Mordecai had an intriguing theory. Since nobody knows when Jesus is going to return, Jesus said even he didn't know. He said only his father knew. That would mean that Satan doesn't know either, which means Satan has always had to be prepared for any eventuality. That means that for almost 2,000 years, he's had to have at least one Antichrist on the earth in position ready to go in every generation since the resurrection, which is why there have been so many evil dictators throughout history. So there has to be someone out there right now, walking around the planet at this very minute, waiting, preparing, plotting. It could be somebody you know. It could be someone I know. It's scary, don't you think?
Bennett took a deep breath. That was enough for now. He again told his mother how much he loved her and promised to call her the moment he had the chance. Then he went looking for Aaron, whom he found in Mordecai's private study. Chapter 32. Thursday, January 15th, 3:12 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. The room had been stripped bare. The books of every shelf were gone. So were the papers and the file cabinets. A PC still sat on the old man's desk, but its hard drive had been ripped out. Even his favorite swivel chair was gone. You think Mossad took it all? Bennett asked, putting his arm around Aaron. I guess, said Aaron, still trying to make sense of it. What do you think they were looking for? Same thing we are, Aaron replied. Any scrap that could point in the right direction. Bennett noticed something under the desk. He bent down to see what it was, only to find a shattered picture frame. He carefully picked through the shards of glass and pulled out a small black-and-white photograph. It was Mordecai and his wife, Yael, on their wedding day at a synagogue in West Jerusalem. He dusted it off and handed it to Aaron, angered by what he was seeing. A murder investigation was one thing. The wholesale removal of a man's most personal possessions from his own home was another thing entirely. Didn't Dr. Barak tell us that Mordecai had come to him with new information about the Copper Scroll sometime shortly after the firestorm? Bennett suddenly asked. Yes, Aaron replied. And isn't that new information what prompted Mordecai to go to Daron and urge him to put together the whole group with Murray and Jaspers? Aaron nodded. And he said that Murray had been meeting with a literary agent the day he died. I don't remember that, said Aaron. You don't? No, she said. Is that what you and Dr. Barak were talking about when we got back from Amman? Yeah. Well, I was talking to Natasha, remember? I didn't hear what you guys were saying. Bennett strained to recall the details of the conversation. Barak said something about how Jaspers had called him and told him Murray was shopping a book proposal around New York, something about the Copper Scroll. Barak was furious with Murray and called him up and said he was jeopardizing everything. Murray told him they had nothing to worry about. Okay, so what was Mordecai's lead? What did he have? Where did he get it from and where is it now? I don't know, said Aaron. Nobody knows. Natasha said she didn't even know. Her grandfather never told her. But someone thought the answer lay in this room, said Bennett. Which is why they took everything, Aaron agreed. The big question is, would they know what they were looking for? I've got a bigger question than that, said Bennett. What's that? Shouldn't there be a backup of all the files that were on Mordecai's PC? They both thought about that for a moment. The war room, said Aaron. They bolted for Mordecai's closet, pushed through the racks of clothes, and found the hidden elevator that had once saved their lives when Saddam Hussein had ordered Operation Last Jihad. Aaron entered the passcode from memory, and 30 seconds later they were in the subterranean chamber that once had been used as a clandestine Mossad operations center. It was here that Aaron and Mordecai had worked so feverishly to keep Bennett alive after that ferocious gun battle with Iraqi terrorists, and it was here that they had watched the U.S. launch its massive attack on Saddam Hussein and his Republican Guard. But this, too, was now all cleaned out. Gone were all the video monitors and the computers, once cross-linked to the Mossad and CIA mainframes. Gone was the mini medical center and the weapons storage closet and the data storage system that had helped Mordecai track the latest world developments and do all the analysis for which he'd become so famous. It had all been ripped out. The room was now just a ghost of what it had been, filled with nothing more than frayed wiring and bittersweet memories. They had hit a dead end. As frustrated as they were exhausted, they made their way back to the elevator and headed up. Aaron checked her watch. They only had a few minutes before the neighborhood security patrol would finish its rounds and come back to check Mordecai's house. What now? Bennett asked as the door slid open and they stepped back into Mordecai's closet. But Aaron didn't answer. She stuck out her arm to block him from moving forward, then pulled out her Beretta. Down the hallway, someone was whispering. Aaron carefully slid off her shoes, moved to the door, and motioned for him to stay put for a moment. Bennett's pulse was racing. His palms were sweaty. Who was out there, and why? It couldn't be the security patrol. There would be no reason for them to whisper. But why else would anybody be in the house, unless they were hunting for the same clue, or hunting for them? Bennett had no weapon. He did, however, have access to the best intel money could buy. He quickly put his BlackBerry on silence mode, then used the tracking wheel to find the live CIA satellite downlink that had helped them get here in the first place. He double-clicked and waited for the connection to kick in. It never did. He just got an error message instead. Server connection lost. That was strange, Bennett thought. It had worked just moments earlier. Now, when they needed it most, it went down? Aaron took a quick peek into the hallway, then darted across the hall to the master bedroom. She cleared that room and caught John's eye again. Downstairs, she signaled, then come back up on the other side. He climbed into the elevator and headed down. When the doors reopened, he crossed through the former ops center and found the other elevator shaft on the opposite wing. He climbed in and pressed the button. Nothing happened. He pressed it again. Still nothing. It was out of order, and suddenly he could feel perspiration running down his back. The main floor was now stone silent. The whispers had ceased. Whoever was out there knew she was here, too. Aaron did another quick peek down the hallway. That's when they unleashed. She pulled back and pressed herself against the bedroom wall, only to see the wall at the end of the hallway torn to shreds by 20 or 30 rounds of automatic weapons fire. As soon as the shooting stopped for a moment, she pivoted around, squeezed off 6 rounds, and dove back into the walk-in closet. She hit the elevator button and waited. Gunfire erupted again in the hall. There were 2 of them, she realized. One would fire a short burst, then the other. They were tag-teaming down the hallway. They were coming for her, and they could be only 8 or 10 yards away at most by now. Aaron pressed the elevator button again. She could hear the muffled sounds of the motor kicking in, but it was still a good 10 seconds away. She didn't have that long. Chapter 33. Thursday, January 15th, 4:02 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Bennett could hear the gunfire above him. It was moving east to west toward Aaron. Should he go back up the west elevator? And do what? He still had no weapon. If Aaron was pinned down, the only good he could do would be to try to ambush these guys from behind. But how? Desperate, he checked every door for a stairway to the main floor, but found none. Instead, he ducked back into the broken elevator and noticed an access panel in the ceiling. He grabbed an old wooden chair, set it in the elevator, climbed on top of it, and pushed the access panel free, then pulled himself up onto the top of the elevator. The shaft was nearly pitch black, pierced only by the lights inside the elevator carriage itself. It wasn't much, but it was enough to find the metal maintenance ladder bolted to the side of the back wall, and that's all he needed. A moment later, Bennett reached the top of the ladder. He pried open the elevator door, climbed back onto the main floor, and found himself in a closet in one of the East Wing guest rooms. That put him at the far end of the house. Now, the shooting stopped, but the gunman let fly a storm of profanities. Bennett's only solace? If Erin were dead, he had no doubt the cursing would stop. Despite the cursing, Erin could hear the elevator rising behind her. She could also hear both men ejecting spent magazines. It was her only chance, and she took it. She pumped 5 shots through the closet wall into the hallway and hit pay dirt. Someone dropped to the floor. She lowered her aim and fired 5 more shots through the drywall into the hallway. The screaming ceased, but now someone else was approaching, and he was coming fast. Just then, the elevator door opened behind her. She dove in, hit the down button, and dropped to the floor as a barrage of AK-47 fire filled the closet. Bennett knew he had to move quickly. He rummaged through the closet looking for a weapon, but all he found were clothes Mordecai hadn't worn in years and would never wear again. He scanned the guest room, but found nothing. The kitchen was on the other side of the house, with knives, a meat cleaver, but he'd never reach it in time. He glanced into the hallway. No one was there. He slid off his shoes, then eased open the guest room door and worked his way toward the great room, terrified of making a sound and drawing gunfire he couldn't return. He found no one there or on the stairs, nor could he see anyone outdoors on the deck overlooking the old city. For the moment, at least, the coast was clear. He made his move, darting behind one of the leather couches and then working his way around to the fireplace. There, he stopped for a moment to slow his breathing. He could hear one of the intruders probing room by room. Whoever it was, he obviously had never been in the house before, Bennett realized. He had no idea about the secret elevator. Was that where Erin had gone? Bennett glanced again at his watch. The sun would be coming up before long, and they desperately needed to be able to make their way back to their temporary residence in the Muslim quarter before daybreak, or there would be no place for them to hide. If he was going to do anything, it had to be now. Slowly, carefully, Bennett removed one of the cast-iron pokers from the stand beside Mordecai's fireplace. Then he moved toward the hallway leading to the west wing and tried to steady his breathing. A few moments later, as he'd anticipated, he heard footsteps. They were heavy and determined and were coming quickly down the hall toward him. He raised the poker like a baseball bat and waited. When the gunman came through the archway into the great room, Bennett swung for the fences. The man was huge, at least 6'6", maybe 250 pounds, but he was caught completely off guard by the force of the poker, which struck him square across the upper lip, just below the nose. His head snapped back. He lost his footing and crashed onto his back. His weapon skidded across the hardwood floor toward the stairs. Bennett leaped for it. Seconds later, he had the AK-47 in his hands. He pivoted quickly to face his assailant, but it was too late. The man was already on top of him, knocking the gun away and pounding him with his fists. Bennett was stunned. He had no idea how the man could have recovered so quickly, but it hardly mattered. The two of them were now hurtling down the stairs, and soon they hit the floor with a bone-crunching thud. The man's hands closed like a vice around Bennett's neck. They were squeezing, squeezing. Bennett couldn't break free. He was gagging and choking, but there was nothing he could do to wrest himself from the man's grip. A wave of panic washed over him. He couldn't breathe, couldn't see, couldn't think, and then, without warning, a single gunshot exploded in his ears. Bennett saw the man's life drain from his eyes. He watched the man slump to the floor, blood pouring out of his mouth, and an involuntary shudder rippled through Bennett's system. He shoved the body off of him and rolled away to safety. When he looked up, he saw his wife at the top of the stairs, the Beretta still pointed at the fallen man's head, the acrid stench of gunpowder once again thick in the air. They stared at each other for a moment, and Bennett realized how close they had both once again come to dying in this house. Erin lowered her gun, scanned the great room behind her one last time, then made her way down the stairway. Bennett got up and went to embrace her, but Erin stopped him abruptly. "Your BlackBerry," she said as she pulled out her own. "What about it?" asked John. "Do you have it on you?" "Of course," he replied. "Why?" "Quick, turn it off," she replied as she did the same. "They must have tracked us here. That's how they found us. They triangulated the signals from our phones. We need to get out of here, fast." She was right. How could they not have thought of it sooner? Bennett turned off his BlackBerry and pulled out his SIM card. On it were the addresses, phone numbers, and email accounts of everybody he knew on Wall Street, in Washington, and in all of the capitals he and Erin had been to around the world over the last few years. It was not something he dared lose. "I checked the guys upstairs," Erin said, rifling through the pockets of the man she'd just shot. "Nothing, no ID, no passport." But this time was different. On him, she found a set of car keys and a cell phone with a built-in camera. She snapped a few shots of all three men before Bennett insisted they get out while they still could. Then they raced outside, found the men's black Mercedes, and borrowed it, at least for a while. Chapter 34. Thursday, January 15th, 4:57 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. To their relief, everyone in the Shokat house was still asleep. They snuck down to the basement, and while Bennett took a quick shower, Erin booted up the desktop computer. She quickly logged back onto the CIA satellite account, re-entered the coordinates for Mordecai's house, and soon had a live, wide shot of his entire neighborhood. For the moment, all appeared calm. No police cars, no ambulances, no media. By daybreak, that would change. But at least they had a few hours' head start. Next, she hacked into the Israeli Police Department's database, using a back door she had learned in her years with the CIA. She immediately uploaded the photos of the men who had tried to kill them and ran a trace. It came back negative. The men weren't locals. She entered the license plate of the Mercedes they had used. Not surprisingly, it was stolen. Then she logged onto the Interpol database and tried again. This time, she got hits on all three attackers. They were Italians, two from Rome, one from Milan. They were members of an underground radical faction known as the Legion, wanted for bombings, bank robberies, and assassinations in France, Spain, Holland, and Germany. The Interpol files had vital stats on all of the men, when and where they'd been born, names of their parents, criminal records, etc., but little on the Legion itself. It was believed to be a splinter group of the Red Brigades, but that was about all Erin could glean without a higher clearance code. She emailed images of each man to Indira Rajiv at Langley, along with a brief note explaining what had just happened at Mordecai's house. "Can you trace this and get back to me, Raj? I need info on the Legion ASAP. Thanks, Erin." She hit send and closed her eyes for a few minutes. She was exhausted, but the attack must mean they were doing something right. The very fact that someone was gunning for them meant Mordecai and Barak and their little band of treasure hunters had been on to something. Someone was systematically hunting down anyone trying to solve the mystery of the Copper Scroll. It didn't prove the crackerjack box contained a prize, but it did prove that someone, somewhere, was rattled by the thought. Suddenly, she opened her eyes, sat up straight in her chair, and began typing on the computer again. She brought up the Yahoo homepage, clicked on mail, and typed in Mordecai's ID. She guessed at his password. She was wrong. "Invalid ID or password," came the response in bright red letters. "Please try again." So she did. She tried every password she could think of. His name, his wife's name, the numbers of his birthday, the numbers of his birthday backward, his wife's name backward, and so forth. But she struck out every time. The door opened behind her. "Mordecai's password," Erin called over her shoulder. "Do you know it?" "To what?" Bennett asked as he dried and combed his hair.
"His Yahoo account."
"I don't know. Why?"
Erin swiveled around in her chair. "Come on. You know the passcodes to get into his house, onto his elevators. You're telling me you don't know how to break into his email account?"
Bennett shook his head. He never asked me to read his mail.
Well, think, John, think.
Why? What are you after?
It's just a hunch, Aaron demurred. I could be wrong, but...
A hunch about what? Bennett pressed.
Just help me break in.
Bennett was still at it as the sun came up. Aaron stepped out of the shower, wrapped a towel around herself, and came to check on his progress. He had 3 pages of possible passwords that he had written down, entered into the Yahoo system, and then crossed off as rejected.
How's it going?
She asked, oddly refreshed, though she hadn't slept a wink. She leaned over his shoulder and gave him a kiss on the cheek.
It's no use, he said, his eyes at half-mast, desperate to crawl back into bed and take her with him.
Spymaster rule number 1. You can't break into a Mossad chief's email account. It simply can't be done, period. End of sentence. It's impossible. You should know that better than anyone.
Wait a minute. That's it, she said.
What's it?
Can I sit there for a moment? Said Aaron.
Sure, if you tell me what's going on.
Nevertheless, he got up and let her have the chair, looking on over her shoulder. She did a quick search for English translations of the Bible. From there, she narrowed the search to New Testament translations online. Then she picked one and typed in the word impossible. 13 results popped up. She scanned the list. There it was. Luke, chapter 1, verse 37. For nothing is impossible with God. It was Mordecai's life creed. She found the login page again and tried Luke 1:37 as the password. It didn't work. She tried Luke 1:37. Nothing.
Come on, we need some sleep, Bennett insisted. We'll try again later.
Aaron sighed.
I know, you're right, she whispered, and began shutting off the lights. I just can't believe I can't crack this thing.
You will, he promised her as he headed over to the couch to lie down.
Just for a few minutes, he insisted. You just need some rest, we both do.
And then I promise, we'll get up and pray about it, and I'm sure God will show us something. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 3, isn't that what Mordecai was always quoting to us?
That was it, Aaron realized.
Call to me, and I will answer you, and I will tell you great and mighty things which you do not know. She turned the lights back on, logged back on, entered Jeremiah 33:3, and waited. Again, she got an error message. She tried Jeremiah 33:3, but that didn't work either. Finally, in desperation, she tried J333 and gasped.
We're in, she declared,
only to find her husband already fast asleep. Hundreds of emails were sitting there unopened. They were waiting for replies that would never come. Aaron had no idea where to begin. She wasn't even entirely sure what she was looking for. All she had was a hunch. Perhaps the clue that had stirred up this hornet's nest had come in by email. Perhaps Mordecai had written to Daron or Barak or the rest of the team about the clue. This was a man, after all, who had communicated with most people most of the time by email. It was inconceivable to her that there wouldn't be something useful here. And the huge number of unopened emails was an encouraging sign. Maybe she'd gotten there first. She quickly sorted the inbox by date received, then isolated all the emails that had come in during the first 2 weeks after the firestorm. As best as she could recall, that was roughly the time Mordecai had first come across the clue, according to Daron. But the more she hunted for the proverbial needle in the haystack, the more Aaron was taken aback by the enormous number of emails she found that Mordecai had written and received that had to do with her, with finding her, with letting the White House and CIA know she had been found, with organizing an extraction to get her and John out of Russia after the firestorm had hit. There were emails to senior officials in the Mossad, to Ken Costello, to Indira Rajiv, to Ruth Bennett, and to dozens of colleagues and associates of Mordecai's located throughout Iran and the former USSR. Until now, Aaron had had no idea just how involved Mordecai had been with their extraction. She knew he was a key player, of course. She and John had, after all, been flown not to Washington after leaving Russian airspace, but to Jerusalem. They'd spent weeks recovering from their ordeal in Mordecai's guest rooms. Only now did it suddenly dawn on her how much John and Mordecai had shielded her from the specifics of her rescue, so she could focus solely on the rest and medical care she so badly needed after being held by Gogolov's forces. What's more, she had unexpectedly uncovered a treasure trove of Mordecai's thinking on all kinds of political and spiritual issues, issues about which he was corresponding with people all over the world. She was eager to explore more, but there was one email that now caught her eye. A gift was all the subject heading said. It was from someone named Kenneth Donovan. It was not a name she recognized, but she was curious about what might be inside. Chapter 35. Thursday, January 15th, 6:28 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel.
John, get up. You need to see this.
He heard the words and the urgency in Aaron's voice, but it took a moment to make sense of it all. He stared at the ceiling, and at the ceiling fan he'd been too busy to notice earlier, but he dreaded the notion of being awake so soon.
What have you got? He groaned.
Black gold, Aaron replied. Texas tea.
What are you talking about?
He forced himself off the couch and stumbled over to her. His bleary eyes took a while to adjust to the words on the screen, but when they did, he was suddenly and completely awake. Dear Dr. Mordecai, please don't toss this into your spam file. You don't know me. In fact, you'll never meet me. But you know my kid brother, or rather, you did, until his death in October 1996. My brother was Raymond S. Donovan. Most of his family and friends believed, and still do to this day, that Ray was a pilot for Continental. But you were among a handful of people who knew the truth, that he was an NOC officer in the CIA's Directorate of Operations. I only learned the truth on being informed of his death by a phone call from the Director of Central Intelligence and becoming executor of his will. That's when I gained access to his safe deposit box and to the secrets it contained. I am writing to you now because in the box was a large sealed envelope with your name on it. I assumed Ray wanted me to get this to you, but frankly, I didn't know how. I had no idea who you were. The CIA proved to be no help. I couldn't find a shred of information about you on the internet, so I finally gave up. But now your Ezekiel option memo has hit the news, and suddenly the whole world knows who you are. I see you have a website and an email address, so I'm passing this whole mess on to you. But first, a confession. When I couldn't track you down back in 96, I decided to open the envelope and see what was inside. It was the most foolish thing I've ever done, and I've done some pretty stupid things in my day. Inside was an audio cassette made by Ray. There was also a copy of an old leather journal he bought somewhere in southern Syria. It's all in Arabic. It makes no sense to me. But the tape is pretty clear, and it has shattered my life. I thought I knew my brother, but the more I learn of the life he was really living, the more I realize how little I knew him. We weren't as close as I thought. Little Ray was living a lie. It turns out he was a felon and a traitor, and I don't know how I could have failed him so badly. As I don't have a mailing address for you, I've converted the audio cassette to an MP3 file and the journal into a PDF file. I've been living with this nightmare for too long. It's yours now. May you have more strength than I. Sincerely, Kenneth J. Donovan. Aaron double-clicked on the audio file, and suddenly they were listening to the voice of Ray Donovan.
Dr. Mordecai, greetings from the hereafter. If you are listening to this, then it can only be for one reason. I have failed, and thus I am dead, and my brother Kenny has found a way to track you down and get you this tape and the accompanying journal. You and I first met at the farm 9 years ago when you addressed my class of new agency recruits. We met again 3 years ago when you were helping my colleague Craig Harkin and I train Kurdish rebels to run sabotage missions in northern Iraq. Ring any bells? Remember me now? If not, perhaps this will jog your memory. About 18 months ago, you took Craig and me to meet with some Bedouin trackers you thought we should hire. We were scheduled to meet them at that archaeological museum in Qumran, and while we were waiting for them to show up, you and I got into a big argument over the Dead Sea Scrolls. You said they were proof that the Bible we have today is the exact same one people had 2,000 years ago. No changes, no alterations, word for word the same. I said religion was fine for old people who needed a crutch, but had no serious basis in science and history. You were very gracious about the old people crack, for which I want to apologize again. But I'll never forget the story you told me next, the story of the Copper Scroll. You insisted that one day the Key Scroll would be found as well, that the Second Temple treasures would be found, that the Ark of the Covenant would be found, and that all these would be further proof, if more were needed, that the Bible is not a myth, not a legend, not some sort of superstitious fiction, but rock-solid history. History that one day would explode into headlines. To your face, I suggested we just agree to disagree. Inside, I was laughing at you all the way back to my hotel. But I have to admit, I was intrigued by what you'd said. Not about the religious part, mind you. What intrigued me was the idea of buried treasure, billions of dollars of buried treasure scattered throughout the West Bank. And then something unexpected happened. It was around Christmas, 1995. Craig and I were in Syria. We were set to meet the economic attaché from the Iraqi embassy, whom we were running as a double agent. He was feeding us intel on Saddam's ties to Hafez al-Assad. We were supposed to meet him that afternoon in a bookstore on the east side of Damascus. As we waited for the guy to show up, I was browsing through a wooden crate of used books, and I came across an old leather journal that caught my eye. It was handwritten in colloquial Arabic, but had originally been written by a rabbi. The first entry was dated December 9, 1924. The last entry was June 9, 1967. How the bookstore got it, I have no idea. Why the store was selling it rather than burning it, I have no idea. Clearly, the store owner hadn't ever read it. But there it was. I didn't ask any questions. I just bought it and stuffed it in my briefcase until after our meeting with the Iraqi. But when I got back to the safe house we were using, I showed the journal to Craig. What immediately caught his attention, as it had mine, was the rabbi's description of a network of ancient smuggling tunnels south of Damascus, running under the Golan Heights. According to local legends, the tunnels were dug in the first century BC by local merchants trying to smuggle goods in and out of Palestine without getting hit by Roman taxes. According to the rabbi's journal, Arab groups were using the tunnels by the late 1920s and early 1930s to smuggle arms and explosives into Palestine to fight the Jews. And as you read through the journal, the rabbi wrote urgent letters to Jewish leaders in Jerusalem, warning them of the old smuggling routes. Then we came to a passage on page 55 in which the rabbi explains that the routes run through territory that used to be home to his great-great-grandparents, an area known to locals as Sichab.
Erin paused the audio file. Bennett looked at her in disbelief. She'd done it. This was it. This was the clue Mordecai had been talking about. Chapter 36. Thursday, January 15th, 6:40 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Erin pulled up the PDF file. She scrolled down to page 55, found the passage to which Donovan referred, and read it aloud, translating from the Arabic. Sichab runs right along the edge of the Syrian border near a place some local Arabs call Tel Shihab. It's a sacred place to my family. My grandfather calls it Kohlit and speaks of it with almost mystical reverence. Erin hit play again. Donovan actually read the passage aloud and then continued his analysis.
Dr. Mordecai, I have to tell you, no sooner did I finish reading that than the hair on the back of my neck began standing on end. I knew those names. I'd heard them before. Finally, I realized where. After you told me the story of the Copper Scroll, I went back to the States and did as much research as I possibly could, and I remembered Line 64. In the tunnel, which is in Sichab, to the north of Kohlit, which opens toward the north and has graves in its entrance, a copy of this text and its explanation and their measurements and the inventory, item by item. Now, as I understand it, scholars long believed the name Sichab referred to plots of land owned by the religious commune that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, and thus was a place where the group could easily have hidden the temple treasures without attracting undue attention. Some said the plots were in the Qumran area, where the other scrolls were found. Others said it had to be farther north, perhaps near Tiberias. But the truth is, no one was ever sure where Sichab was. In my research, though, I found a quote by Father Bargil Pixner. As you no doubt recall, Pixner was a member of the original team of archaeologists from L'École Biblique and the American School of Oriental Research who discovered the Copper Scroll, and he said, and I quote, "They, the Essenes, had treasures hidden away, and I think that those hiding places are the ones mentioned in the Copper Scroll. I have deduced that they must have owned these areas in order to have had access to them to hide the treasures. These hiding places were called Koklit, monastic centers of the community. One Koklit was in Qumran itself, although it was not called Qumran, since this is an Arabic word, but was called Sakaka, a place mentioned in the Bible. A second Koklit was on Mount Zion, and a third one, in my opinion, was in an area of the Yarmouk River, south of Damascus." On the map, on page 60 of the journal, Donovan continued, "You'll see the Sea of Galilee on the west and Golan Heights dead center, and the Yarmouk River to the east, running down the mountains and through a place called Wadi Shihab. The river, as you can see, supposedly leads to a waterfall, which lies just to the north of Tel Shihab."
"Stop the tape," Bennett said, and Aaron did.
"What is it?" she asked.
"Scroll through the PDF file a bit farther," he said. "I want to find that map." Sure enough, on page 60, she found the map drawn by the rabbi. She started the recording again.
"To be honest, Craig and I couldn't resist the temptation to verify the map. So, under the guise of needing more intel for our project with the Kurds, Operation November Thunder, we requested updated, high-resolution satellite photography of the Golan Heights and the Yarmouk River. Sure enough, using thermal imaging, we could clearly see traces of a tunnel running from a cave on the Israeli side of the Golan through the mountains, across the demilitarized zone, and winding up in a cave at the base of the waterfall. The opening of the cave is not that far from a forward Syrian monitoring post, but since the cave itself is inside the DMZ, we doubt it's ever been explored by the Syrians, much less the Israelis. Now, here's my point, Dr. Mordecai. I am absolutely convinced the key scroll is hidden at the end of that tunnel. So is Craig. We know the CIA would never let us explore it. The whole place is guarded by barbed wire, landmines, and impressive electronic surveillance, not to mention 10,000 crack Syrian troops, all on a hair trigger to go to war with the Israelis on a moment's notice. One wrong move, and kaboom. But we can't help it. We're going to find a way into that tunnel, even if it kills us. Which, obviously, it has. Craig and I are dead now. That's the only reason you're hearing this tape and reading this journal. Perhaps we died in the tunnels. Perhaps someone found out what we were up to and tried to stop us. Perhaps the Israelis or the Syrians captured us along the way and we've died in prison or by firing squad. It really doesn't matter. All that matters is that someone finds the treasure. I believe it should be you. All the best. Maybe I will see you on the other side."
And with that, the audio file came to an end. Bennett was stunned. So was Aaron.
"No wonder Mordecai was so sure he was on the verge of a major breakthrough," she said. "He was."
"He was," Bennett echoed, staring at the computer monitor and wondering if Barak had heard this. Had the others? Had they read the journal as well?
"Did you know these guys?" he asked instead. "Who, Harkin and Donovan?" said Aaron.
"Right."
"No, not personally, but I'd heard of them. Rumors, really. People said they went rogue. As far as I know, the agency never did find their bodies. They just listed them as missing and presumed dead. But there was always something a bit fishy about it. I'm not sure if their files were ever formally closed."
"What about this brother?" said Bennett. "Do a search. If we can find him, we might be able to learn more." Aaron swiveled back around in her chair and typed the name Kenneth J. Donovan into a news search engine and hit enter. A second later, a headline popped up from the Rocky Mountain News. "Local man commits suicide on Thanksgiving." Bennett shook his head. That had been just weeks after the firestorm. Everywhere they turned, the death toll kept rising. He got up and paced the room.
"What are you thinking?" asked Aaron. "I'm thinking we may not be the only people who have this journal," he replied, the anxiety showing on his face.
"If we are, it won't be for long. The original is still out there somewhere. Who knows who got a hold of it after Donovan committed suicide? If it really was a suicide, Aaron noted. You think he might have been murdered? It would certainly fit with everything else we've found. You may be right, said Bennett, mulling their options. What about sending an email to Rajiv? Maybe she knew Donovan and Harkin. She might have something that could help us. Good idea, said Aaron. Give me a few minutes. We need to move fast, Bennett insisted. When you're done with that, get Natasha up. Have her listen to the tape and see what she thinks. Then print out a copy of the journal and delete the file. I'm going to get the car. I'll meet you at the Damascus Gate in 1 hour. If for whatever reason I don't show, don't wait. Go without me. What are you talking about? Aaron asked. Go where? To the DMZ, Bennett said as he headed up the stairs. We need to find the key scroll before anyone else does. Chapter 37. Thursday, January 15th, 9 a.m., Babylon, Iraq. It was Salvador Lucente's first visit to the new Iraqi capital. He had met President al-Hassani on numerous occasions, including a weekend at Camp David with President McPherson and at the opening session of the United Nations General Assembly the previous September. The Iraqi president had also been a guest of the EU leadership in Brussels twice before, and they spoke together by phone or video conference at least once a week. But there was something different about actually landing at the dazzling new Babylon International Airport and being driven to the Great Tower of the People in a 20-vehicle screaming motorcade down massive new highways, all paid for by U.S. and EU taxpayers. How quickly the world could change, Lucente realized. It hadn't been that long since Saddam Hussein had brutalized these people and forced them to live in such squalor. Nor had it been that long since America destroyed Saddam's regime and fought a brutal war of attrition with Iraqi insurgents. Who could have imagined in those dark days, when the entire country teetered on the brink of civil war, that Iraq would finally crush the rebellion, see order restored to its streets, and become a magnet for capitalists rather than car bombers? The motorcade passed a sign announcing the upcoming opening of the famed Hanging Gardens. They passed the dazzling new Iraqi Museum of Archaeology and Antiquities, complete with its own IMAX theater, bringing the ancient history of Babylonia to life in 3D and THX surround sound. Lucente was stunned by how much construction was underway in the city, by how much progress had been made in just a few short years, and it suddenly struck him how powerful a force al-Hassani and his people were rapidly becoming.
Welcome, my friend. How wonderful to see you again.
It is an honor to be here, Your Excellency, Lucente responded, receiving from al-Hassani the traditional Arab kisses on both cheeks.
Come, come, let us enjoy the morning sunshine, the Iraqi president insisted, leading Lucente through his private office to the balcony overlooking the city. Have a seat. Make yourself comfortable. Breakfast will be served to us in a few minutes, but first some coffee? Fresh squeezed orange juice? What would you like?
The two men settled in, exchanged pleasantries, and ate their breakfasts, admiring the views and sharing tidbits of news about the relief efforts ongoing across the region. But when their plates were cleared, they finally turned to the business at hand.
Mr. President, Lucente began at last, as you know, I have just come from Jerusalem, where I toured the areas of the worst devastation and had some very frank conversations with Prime Minister Daron. And, as you requested, I insisted that he forestall any plans to build a Jewish temple until, at the very least, we can all re-engage in final status negotiations and hammer out a peace treaty between the Israelis and the Palestinians once and for all.
And how did the Prime Minister respond? Asked al-Hassani as he began lighting up his pipe.
Let's just say he was non-committal, Lucente explained.
You don't think the aid package you offered will be enough?
Frankly, I doubt it.
Why?
It's simple, really, said Lucente. At the moment, Europe is getting 60% of our oil from Medexco. Daron acts like he needs our aid. He'd love as much international assistance as possible, who wouldn't? But with oil topping 175 euros a barrel,
He knows full well that he doesn't need us as much as we need him right now. Which, I assume, is why you are here.
It is, Mr. President. Our economies are choking. Unemployment is soaring. We can't operate with oil prices this high. We have got to get oil flowing out of the Gulf states again within the next few months. My advisors tell me that's possible, but it will take an enormous effort, and it's one that we simply cannot take on by ourselves. Lucente noted that Iraq was in a far better position to take the lead in bringing the petroleum facilities in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, and the other regional OPEC players online, and doing it quickly. Right now, you and the Israelis are experiencing a great windfall, Lucente noted. But you know as well as I do that if the global economy slips into a depression, everyone loses. That's why I have been asked by the various leaders of the EU to make our position very plain. You must get oil prices down below 100 euros a barrel by summer, or I am afraid we will have to consider some unpleasant scenarios. Startled, Al-Hassani stared into Lucente's eyes. Had he heard the man correctly?
Mr. Foreign Minister, did you just threaten me?
Of course not, Mr. President, Lucente replied coolly. You know how much Europe has done to rebuild your country. I have no doubt you will now help us in our time of need.
Or else? Asked Al-Hassani.
I wouldn't put it that way, Lucente replied.
Didn't you just?
Lucente paused a moment, then leaned toward Al-Hassani and spoke almost in a whisper. You have a formidable military, Mr. President. 200,000 troops armed with the latest weaponry. I know, because we, NATO and the Americans, recruited them, trained them, equipped them, and helped them gain combat experience in crushing the insurgency. But do not deceive yourself. Your forces are not yet ready to face the combined forces of a unified Western alliance, determined to achieve energy security at all costs. And who might your allies be? You think I don't know about the little conclave you held here the other day? Did you think you could shuttle in leaders from all over the region without our notice? They cannot help you now. Do not miscalculate, as Iraqi leaders are wont to do. Your country cannot afford a misstep. The black Mercedes headed north on Highway 90. If they weren't stopped and arrested first, they would be in Tiberias in less than an hour. Natasha's cousin had a house up there, in the hills, overlooking the Sea of Galilee. They would go there first, Bennett had decided, hunker down until dark, then head for the Golan Heights. Time was not on their side, but none of them thought it wise to be seen in the mountains in daylight.
We want Russia's seat, Al-Hassani began.
So does Israel, Lucente countered. He could tell by the look in Al-Hassani's eyes that he had caught him by surprise.
They have not made that public, Al-Hassani noted cautiously.
Nor have you, said Lucente. Doron just told me yesterday. By now, he has talked to the Americans.
Nevertheless, said Al-Hassani, if you want our oil, we want a permanent seat on the Security Council. It can be Russia's, it can be new, but it is non-negotiable. We want assurances that neither the EU nor the US nor the UN will interfere with our efforts to unify the region's political and economic structures.
In other words, you want carte blanche to rebuild the Babylonian Empire.
We have the same right to reorganize our region of the world as you had in reorganizing Europe. We are not asking for your permission. We are looking for assurances that no one will interfere.
Such as
withdrawal of foreign troops from the region, coordination of all relief and reconstruction efforts through my office, not through the UN, guaranteed accession to the WTO, a few others, I will give you a list.
Lucente took it all in without tipping his hand one way or the other.
"There is one more thing," said Al-Hassani.
Lucente waited. Al-Hassani said nothing.
"Let me guess," Lucente said at last.
"Jerusalem." Al-Hassani nodded.
"The UN must seize control of the Temple Mount. The Jews must not be allowed to build anything there, not a temple, not a visitor center, not a falafel stand, nothing, ever, period."
"Or else?" asked Lucente.
"I wouldn't put it that way," said Al-Hassani, a slight twinkle in his eye.
"Didn't you just?" Chapter 38. Thursday, January 15th, 9:30 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel.
"Mr. Prime Minister, we have a situation developing." Doron looked up to see a very agitated Avi Zadok, flanked by the heads of the Shin Bet and the Border Patrol, along with the Chief of Police.
"What have you got?" Doron asked, removing his reading glasses and setting them on the desk.
"Three more murders," Zadok explained.
"Where?"
"Eli Mordecai's house."
"What? When?" asked Doron, standing.
"We just found them, but the bodies have been there most of the night."
"Are they connected to the other killings last night?"
"Ballistics is running tests right now. We should know soon, but yes, we believe they're connected to the killings at the cafe in the Jewish quarter, and to the others in the Arab market a short while later. We're just not sure how yet."
"Have you found any witnesses?"
"The police are canvassing the neighborhood, but nothing so far."
"Keep me up to speed, Avi. I want reports every 15 minutes.
Lucente looked the Iraqi president in the eye.
"I'm not sure if I can deliver on the Temple Mount."
But Al-Hassani didn't believe him.
"Do not take me for a fool, Salvador. I know Mogande is dying. I know you're angling for the Secretary General position. And I know you have almost all the votes you need to be nominated. Almost. But my sources tell me that China is threatening to veto you unless you get oil flowing out of the Middle East again, which means you need a deal with me, and you need it quick."
"And you trust these sources?" Lucente asked.
"With my life," Al-Hassani said firmly.
Lucente turned and looked out across Babylon, glowing in the morning sun.
"Very well. You are correct," he confirmed. "China would be more supportive if I can help them with their energy needs."
"So, no deal with me, no job for you?" asked
Al-Hassani.
"Not quite, my friend," Lucente countered.
"As I said before, if you don't cut a deal favorable to the global powers, I assure you, I will be the least of your worries. But on one thing, you are correct. I am in more of a bargaining mood than the rest of the Security Council. So let me be clear. If you cut a deal with me, one that I can announce to the rest of the world, I will guarantee you Russia's seat on the Security Council."
Al-Hassani leaned back in his seat.
"And the rest?"
"Everything but the Temple Mount."
"Come, come, Salvador," said Al-Hassani, lighting his pipe again. "You can do better than that."
"I cannot guarantee the internationalization of the Temple Mount, Mr. President," Lucente responded. "In case you hadn't noticed, Israel has just become an economic superpower. Even if you can get oil flowing out of the Gulf again in the next 3 to 6 months, most of the world will still be buying most of their oil from Medexco. They have us over a barrel, Mustafa, literally. My hands are tied."
Al-Hassani grew angry.
"You want to be the Secretary General? You want to bring about global peace and prosperity? Then how can you, of all people, even consider for one moment the notion of the Jews building a temple on land sacred to all Middle Easterners? Do you not know what that will unleash?"
"I never said I favored the idea," Lucente insisted. "I'm just being honest with you. I don't know if I can stop it. But I can promise you this. I will try."
As soon as Lucente left, Khalid Tariq rushed into the room.
"Your Excellency, it's Mariano. He says it's urgent."
Al-Hassani accepted the call.
"What is it, Vigo?"
"Sir, We have a problem.
What is it?
Alonso and Scarpetti are dead. So is Mileto. Bennett and his wife killed them and took their car.
What about the Barack girl? Did they get her at least?
No, I don't think so.
What? How could this have happened? You assured me both Baracks would be dead by now, did you not?
I said it might take a few days.
And it's been a few days, countered Al-Hassani. Where are they now?
They're on the run,
said Mariano.
I don't know where, but at this point there are only two realistic options.
I'm listening.
First, they're fleeing the country, in which case they'll go dark, and we won't find them until they choose to pop back up on the grid.
And the other?
They know where the key scroll is, and they're on their way to get it.
Al-Hassani's face turned dark red.
You cannot let that happen, Vigo. You must stop them, whatever it takes.